You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
When I'm rocking the table while he's operating, you waited long to stop debating. Cause I'm back, I'm on the brag and ovulating. I know that you got a job, Miss Cheney, but your husband's heart problem's complicated. So the FCC won't let me be, you let me be me. You don't let me see. They try to shut me down on MTV, but it feels so empty without me. So come on in, come on your lips, jump back, jiggle a hip and wiggle a bit and get ready. This is about to get heavy. I just settled all my lawsuits. Fuck you, Devin.
Can't believe I did my
Warning.
A visionary, vision is scary, can start a revolution, polluting the airwaves.
At my signal.
So just let me revel in mask in the
unleash
hell. I got everyone kissing my ass, and it's a disaster. Such a catastrophe for you to see, so damn much of my ass you ask for me. Well, I'm back, fix your penance and I'm tuning in and I'm gonna enter in and up under your skin like a splinter. The center of attention, back for the winner, I'm interesting. The best thing since wrestling.
Stand by to receive our transmission.
Attention, please.
Feel attention. Soon as someone mentions me, here's my 10 cents. My 2 cents is free. A nuisance. Who sent you?
I'll explain, and I'll use small words so that you'll be sure to understand. You wart-faced buffoon.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
John McCain's campaign claims that John McCain is responsible for helping invent the BlackBerry. But did you know the BlackBerry was invented in Canada? Call John McCain and tell him the next time he lies about helping invent something to lie about an American company.
I'm Al Gore and I approve this message.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome to this week's fully independent, non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. For 3 years now, we've been bringing you alternative voices from around the country and the world. Voices the six mega corporations that control 95% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not want you to know. If you like your news and information chewed up, regurgitated, sanitized, and spoon-fed to you by the corporate handlers, then this is not the place for you. Feel free to surf the all-hate AM radio dial format, or any alphabet news programs for that matter, from like ABC to Fox News to NPR. There you can find the comfortable news shaped and fitted for your consumption. Just the right amount to homogenize this and sanitize that added to you for your comfortable white bread palate. If you prefer with a little more flavor, the spice of truth, then this is your home each and every week here on The Mike Cannon Show. The Mike Cannon Show is produced out of the Glee Glee Studios for not-for-profit community and or micropower radio use worldwide. And again this week, we'll be bringing you mostly the format you've come to know and love. Also this week, towards the top of the hour, as usual, you'll be getting the segment I produce for the alternative media world out there, This Week in Radical History. Between those two things, we'll be trying to fit as many shorter segments like Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Pico Check-In, Women's E! News, and Black Agenda Radio, to name a few, as we can fit in. As always, anything we can't fit in this first hour, we'll be bringing you this second hour. However, for today's show, we'll be starting out with a short 5-minute audio summarizing the RNC police riots from a few weeks ago. As of today, Minneapolis-St. Paul police are still trying to prosecute 8 organizers from the Welcoming Committee with terrorism charges. Now, one would think with 8 terrorists living in the heartland, more people would be concerned. And one would think the media would want to cover that. They are not, of course, and not covering, of course, because people understand how watered down the term terrorism has been when you try to apply to a bunch of domestic protesters. Well, here's that short segment. As always, thanks for taking some time out of your day to listen to this little ditty, The Mike Cannon Show.
Get out of there, it's going to blow!
So we're here today, as you might be aware of what's been happening over the past few days, mm-hmm. with indiscriminate police violence on the streets of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and also we've had reports of severe brutality inside the jails, denial of medication for people who need it, mm-hmm. and we're calling on the mayor to demand 3 things, essentially. Mm-hmm. But before I do that, is there any statement or comment that the mayor's office would like to make about what's going on right now?
What that was,
but
it blew up.
I
don't know if you
can
see it from there. Wow.
There.
Holy shit.
Oh, God, what is that?
That is a freaking grenade. Oh, my God. That just blew up on these kids. On these students. That was a literal, holy fuck, explosion. Excuse my language on the air here.
Right, police? Right here in the hallway. I assume you
have you need to
authority
intervene,
over
Bob.
The building.
Not. Come here.
I assume you have more authority over
I'm
the
not coming
building.
Out. You're coming out.
I'm not coming out. We're okay.
Well, we're standing behind you then.
Yeah, we're okay. Thank you for coming.
There's no need for police to...
We're here peacefully and respectfully. That's what Mr. Bob Hume had to say, okay?
Who works here?
I do. We're just having a conversation. We're okay.
People getting this on film?
They're taking off.
You people should be ashamed of yourselves. You know that, right? You should be ashamed of yourselves. The way you're conducting this city right now is a travesty.
Mm-hmm.
I
hear your concerns. When you kind of make a statement.
This is a very serious thing that's going on here. This is not a game. And we expect action from
they're
the mayor.
I understand your concerns. I understand your concern.
All right. It doesn't sound like you're hearing us. I mean, you didn't want to go outside to tell them to leave. You were forced to talk to them.
Ramsey County provides the security for this building. We did not call these folks up here. That did not come from our office.
Look, I'm not concerned about who called the riot police in here. I'm concerned about the reaction that the mayor is having or not having on what's going on in the streets of St. Paul and even in the office of the mayor.
A 19-year-old activist named Elliot Hughes said he was beaten and tortured inside the Ramsey County Jail.
My name is Elliot Hughes, ELLIOTHUGHES.
I was biking alongside of a march, and I, a officer on a bicycle crashed into me, and I got up and apologized, and they said it wasn't on purpose, and then but they continued to arrest me, stating that I assaulted a police officer. I was then taken to Ramsey County Jail. Several officers opened my cell and said that I was going in a restraining chair, and I asked what this restraining chair was, where were you taking me, where were you taking me, and the officer punched me in the face, right here. He knocked me on the ground, unconscious, and then while I was on the ground, unconscious, he took my head and slammed it on the ground and reawoke me from consciousness, and that caused this gash right here. I immediately reawaking into consciousness, I began screaming and crying, asking for help why they did that. Several officers picked me up and dragged me out, leaving behind a large pool of blood. They took me in. They then took me into the hallway and put a bag over my head that and I could not see. It was slightly transparent, but it blurred my vision, and it had a gag around the mouth, so I couldn't make my words clearly. They then took me into a detaining cell by myself with several officers, and they began using pain compliance tactics on me. What pain compliance is, it's a form of torture. What they did is they pressed right here as hard as they could on both sides. And it's a really sensitive nerve and muscle right there, and it hurts like no other pain I've ever felt in my life. And they wrap my leg around my back and twisted my ankle backwards, and I was screaming and crying at this time. And the more I screamed and cried, the more they would, the harder they would press, and the more they would twist my ankle. I'm gonna faint. I don't know what's happening. And then I vomited in this bag. They refused to take the bag off of my head. They left that bag on my head for about 2.5-3 hours, and on top of vomiting, I'm bleeding all over, and they wouldn't clean any of my wounds or anything.
Do you have anything to say about that?
I can't speak to any particular incident. I don't have any facts on that particular case.
Will you? How about a criminal investigation into that matter?
I'm not prepared or authorized to.
Are you
going to
take this information to the mayor and make sure he does something about it?
Well, I will absolutely pass along your concerns to the mayor.
Here is a fellow RNC arrestee, Mike Cannon.
If you've been listening to the show for the last 2 weeks, you have heard all the reports of the police misconduct at the RNC and DNC for that matter. It got almost no press in the mainstream media. Even when someone as popular and supposedly powerful enough as Amy Goodman and her crew, as well as the AP photographer, got rounded up. Of course, then who would care about the dozens to hundreds of us non-professional journalists that also got rounded up? I won't go into it more again here, but if you're interested in some of the great reporting, you can go to the radioforall.net website, where I post my show each and every week for more details from my reporting and reports from other journalists. That is radioforall.net. Coming up next will be Eat the State. This week's Eat the State talks a lot about the financial meltdown happening. Before that, I'll be bringing you a fast 2-minute piece from that jackass Kramer, who was asked to come on to the MSN to give his amazing insights into the financial crisis. Not only did the financial planner Kramer, who gets his own show on cable network, get the whole Bernd Stern thing wrong, but now, like all these talking heads, he's again asked for his opinion. Only in our media world do you keep coming back and back to the same people who were grossly wrong the first time for the second, third, or fourth bite at the apple. Ask yourself why, how the same talking heads are still given airtime after how wrong they were about Iraq. and they never give any time to anybody who is correct about it from the word go, and there was plenty of us out there. Anyway, Kramer, as a normal conservative attack plan, now wants to attack the messenger and blames the intellectuals and the academics for the financial crisis. Here's that segment. Thanks for tuning in to this fully non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, heard in each and every week Monday on 93.3 WNRB LP in Wausau, Wisconsin, and also found at radioforall.net. Thanks for listening.
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
The Western world was on the precipice yesterday. I thought Goldman and Morgan really could go under. Yep. These are real companies with real people working. Do we want any of this to really happen? Isn't there an interest beyond the notion that the shorts might get hurt on a triple witch? Isn't there a constitution which talks about promoting, right, the general welfare? Mm-hmm. That's what this ended up being about.
Well, no. Here's the problem in my view. Perception is going to be that once again, the taxpayer is footing the bill to bail out people who behaved with extreme greed. You know, we're not going to get Frank Rehn's $90 million bucks back right, that he took right. out of there. And right. the taxpayer is now paying the bill. That's not right.
I think we're very close to the financial stone age and the idea of barter, the idea of riots someday. You know what? That's worth avoiding if we can. They never understood that this was a problem of 3.5 million people who bought homes who were overstretched, that not working because everything they did was elegant and, frankly, Princeton-like. It was debating society. You needed to get these pieces of paper off. There was no price. We know Merrill Lynch sold them for a nickel if you add in the financing. Everything they did was completely and utterly wrong. And everything they did was all about academics and having no visceral knowledge of how easy it is to destroy confidence. If you destroy Lehman Brothers, why shouldn't you destroy Goldman?
Well,
if you can confiscate AIG,
right.
When they did Fannie Mae, the day after they said that there was no need for capital, I didn't understand why anyone should ever have money in a bank again. Then frankly, Western world really will not exist as we thought about it.
And I know you do too.
Well,
but
Cox
today,
knew nothing. Is
okay.
he still there? Is he still the SEC chairman?
Yes, he is.
Well, that's just a joke.
Is today's trade potentially hugely distorted?
I reiterate that the destruction of the Western world's financial world was on the table.
Okay.
I reiterate that.
I don't buy that. But
we could reinvent the system and have Wells Fargo be the universal bank. No problem. But there wasn't any reason for what was happening. I don't want to ban short selling. That is just horrible. But we needed to get the mortgages off the books. Everybody but the U.S. government knew what was going on. Everyone. And Cox was probably the worst. But Bernanke was just, he is just a debating society guy at the university club.
You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP. It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning. This week's economic news.
Yeah, the economy's been the big headliner all this week and for much of last week as well. And I just want to talk, last week we talked a little bit about bailouts. This week I want to talk about just the crisis itself. I've been getting a lot of questions from people. The first question, of course, is how did it all start? Back in 1999, the Congress repealed the Depression-era law, the Glass-Steagall Act, and that repeal allowed financial companies to own a financial company could own a commercial bank, an investment bank, mortgage brokerages, a consumer lending unit, etc. And they could do that all under one roof. So, and it removed a whole bunch of controls. And this coincided with the invention of a lot of derivatives and unusual securities. So before 1999, in essence, you had commercial banks, which were separate from investment banks, which were separate from brokerage firms, which were separate from insurance companies, etc. But then after 1999, anyone could own any of these units and they could put them all together in one company. And so anyone basically could issue risky mortgages, and pretty much just about everybody who could make mortgages did that. And then anybody who didn't issue mortgage loans, they could go out and they could buy what's called a CDO or a mortgage-backed security. And so they could invest in risky mortgages. So now the question becomes, how could these mortgage-backed securities have led to this whole mess that we're in, that we've seen happen this week, including the what many analysts are saying, the almost complete collapse of the U.S. financial markets. Well, you have to just look very closely at the nature of mortgage-backed securities. The whole crisis is based on a very, very simple problem. And this is key. Banks made risky loans. Banks that owned brokerage firms that owned these mortgage lending units made these risky loans. Then they called these loans assets, and they turned them around and used them as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, and on and on and on into infinity. So that's the nature of the problem. Basically, banks making risky loans, calling those loans assets, using those assets as collateral to borrow more money, using that borrowed money to make more risky loans, turning those risky loans again into assets to borrow more money, and on and on and on and on. And as you might expect, all these layers of debt means that it's very, very difficult to know how much is out there. But it's clear that it was done in such volumes that it absolutely dwarfed the amount of actual cash on hand that any of these banks had. And it even dwarfed their other assets. So in the case of some banks, it dwarfed the value of their commercial banks. Commercial banks being the bank that you go to on the street corner where you deposit your money and you have your cash and savings, etc. So these layers and layers and layers of debt are enormous. Back in August 2007, well, actually before then, subprime loans, these risky loans that were made, these subprime loans started to go bad sometime around 2006, but it didn't really hit the market in such volumes until about August 2007. That's when the big banking companies had to take their first big multi-billion dollar write down.
Can I ask a question about the volume of the debts?
Yeah.
How can the volume of the debts be higher than the combined value of the original risky mortgages that were sold? How does that multiply?
That's not what I said. That's not what I said. What I said is that banks made some initial risky mortgages.
Yes.
And they took those risky mortgages and they called them assets. They bundled them together and made mortgage-backed securities, which they called assets. Then they used those assets as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, which they then bundled together as mortgage-backed securities and called them assets, used those assets as collateral to borrow more money to make more risky loans, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got layers and layers and layers of bad loans that were at one point determined to be assets that were used as collateral to make more loans. So you see how it layers up?
Okay, so if I want to come back to this later when we talk about where do we go from here.
Uh-huh.
But so the value of the liquidity crisis that's out there is still basically the value of all the bad loans that are out there.
Yes, yes, and the truth is nobody knows how much bad debt is out there. That's very key to the crisis is, you know, numbers get thrown around like this government bailout. People say, oh, it's going to be a minimum 500 billion, maybe up to a trillion. The truth is they don't know. 500 billion is a number pulled out of a hat. Basically, what they did is they said, well, the IMF said that the whole crisis will be about $1 trillion. And the Fed and the Treasury have already committed about 500 to 600 billion to the crisis. So let's see, 1 trillion minus 500 billion is 500 billion. That's how they came up with that number. Essentially, they're just scratching their heads and pulling a number out of the hat. The truth is the government bailout could be way more than a trillion. It could be less than 500 billion. We don't know. We have no clue. And that's what's been key to the problems in the market, because when you ask the question, why now? Why didn't everything collapse back in August 2007 when the first write-downs were taken? Why is it happening right now? Why didn't it happen sooner? You know, if you ask that question, it's an obvious question, you get the answer of, first, 1 year has gone by since the crisis first hit, and in spite of all the happy talk that's happened over that year, the write-downs have not ceased. Companies are still reporting big write-downs, which means that it's clear nobody knows, not even the heads of these companies that made all of these risky loans. So that's what the problem is. A year has gone by. It's a psychological date, really, for the market and for investors. and for these companies. It's a psychological date. 1 year has gone by. Things are no better. In fact, they're getting worse. And so now we're starting to see people panic and say, I got to get my money out. Well,
Can I ask another question on
sure,
the why now?
Sure.
I want to ask the other end of it. Why, when it's so obviously in the Bush administration's interest to try and delay this crisis for another, oh, say, 7 weeks, mm-hmm. Why couldn't they have taken some sort of a fundamental step that would have put it off until after the election?
The government can't control the markets, essentially. And the Bush administration is hobbled by its extreme right-wing ideology that you leave the markets to themselves and government should never intervene if you can possibly help it in the markets because the markets will right themselves. And you could see that in the Fed's actions few weeks. In fact, in the past few months, when Bear Stearns in March was in trouble and was at the risk of failing, everybody said, you gotta bail him out because if Bear Stearns goes, our whole financial markets go. And the Treasury and the Fed stepped in and they bailed him out. Well, when Lehman Brothers came up, and this is, you know, this week, this is leading into these events of this week, when Lehman Brothers was on the verge of failing, they, about a week ago, they had a good offer for a buyout from an investment company, from a couple of investment firms, wanted to buy them and said, we're going to make you this offer. You're not going to like the price that we're going to give you, but we will buy you out and you can avoid a bankruptcy. And Lehman Brothers looked at the terms of the offer and they said, no, we'll take a pass on that because, you know, the Fed bailed out Bear Stearns and we think they'll bail out us. So they went to the Fed and the Fed said, and you have to understand that the Fed and the Treasury Secretary, but most particularly the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, have been sitting in these meetings at the White House where you've got these right wingers, George Bush and Dick Cheney, with their right wing ideology that says you never interfere with markets. And they're getting pressure from the president to not do bailouts. Because that's left wing. Yeah, it's too left wing for them. They want you to leave the markets alone, let these companies fail, make people take the pain, right? So here's, and yet the Treasury Secretary and the Fed both realize that if you let these companies fail, it's going to be chaos. And they understand that these companies are so big now because of all the deregulation. These companies have gotten so big that if one of them fails, it's going to take down markets all over the world, and that's going to have political fallout. This is something that George Bush and Dick Cheney don't understand, but something that Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke at the Fed, they understand this. Well, so Paulson's getting pressure from the president not to do bailout, and so Lehman comes up, the fourth largest investment bank, not the largest, which was Bear Stearns, but the fourth largest. It comes up, wants a handout, and Henry Paulson has to say no. So he said no. And Lehman, taken completely by surprise, you know, and saw their stock drop precipitously, and they had to declare bankruptcy. And basically, the Fed let them fail. The Fed and the Treasury let them fail.
And it was too late to go back on that previous deal that had been offered them?
Yeah, it was too late because once the Fed says, no, we can't give you a loan, then other companies go, oh, my God, maybe they're in worse trouble than we thought. We don't want to buy them now.
Well, plus the value of their stock dropped precipitously.
Yeah, and so they're really not worth what they were before. It was a good deal for those investment firms to make the offer when they did, when Lehman Brothers was worth more. But when the stock drops precipitously and they're worth less, that deal's off the table completely.
93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.
It's the largest bankruptcy in history, $639 billion in assets. And you might ask, how can a company with $639 billion in assets go bankrupt? Well, it's, as Job said, a liquidity crisis. They can't sell those assets. And there's a question of how much of those $639 billion in assets are really worth that much at this point.
And it's a measure of how big the news has been this week that the largest bankruptcy in the history of the country is maybe the third or fourth biggest financial story of the week.
Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, Merrill Lynch was smart enough to take the deal that Bank of America offered them and not hold out for a Fed rescue, I think because they saw what was happening to Lehman Brothers and they read the political currents correctly and decided, well, we will sell ourselves to Bank of America for 50 cents on the dollar, which is what they did. And then, of course, AIG hit the news, the massive insurance company, which is not just an insurance company. They do all kinds of things, including they have a business where they lease planes from the Boeing company, or they buy planes from the Boeing company to lease out to their customers. So they're involved, as I said, because Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999. Insurance companies can do all kinds of different things, and finance companies can do all kinds of different things now. But you might ask the question, how could an insurance company get sucked so deeply into this? And how in the heck they didn't have mortgage-backed securities? What is the problem? Well, the problem is AIG sold huge amounts of a credit derivative. Now, the credit derivative is called a credit default swap. What it is basically is it's an insurance policy sold to companies that bought mortgage-backed securities. Say you're an investment bank like Goldman Sachs, for example. You bought a lot of mortgage-backed securities and you looked at those and you said, we got to manage this risk somehow. What happens if our mortgage-backed securities lose value? We need to buy something that will hedge our bets, something that will pay us off if these drop in value. So they bought this product from AIG called a credit default swap, which is an insurance policy that will pay them if their mortgage-backed securities will pay, you know, Goldman Sachs and any other company that bought them. It will pay them money if their mortgage-backed securities fall in value. Well, and what has happened over the past year? The market in mortgage-backed securities has plummeted, and most of them are not worth anything. And so now people are lining up to try to get money out of AIG for their losses, and AIG sold billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of these things, and they don't have the cash to back them up and make the payments on them. So that's why AIG is in trouble. And it just goes to the question of how could companies write these risky derivatives and be able to sell them and not be required to have a minimum amount of cash on hand to cover losses in case there are calls on these derivatives. It's because the markets are deregulated. There's no regulation to force that. So you might ask, why did the government bail out AIG when they didn't bail out Lehman Brothers? The answer to that is these derivatives were sold not just to Goldman Sachs, but to banks all over the world and to foreign governments, to institutional investors. That pretty much any institutional investor that bought mortgage-backed securities bought a certain number of credit default swaps. And so it's an enormous problem. It's not just a U.S. financial problem, it's a global economic problem, and in fact it could become a national security issue if you let a company like AIG fail. So then the other question is, what is the bailout deal and what will taxpayers get from it? Well, what the Fed did this week is the Federal Reserve Bank loaned $85 billion to AIG cash, $85 billion cash to AIG at a usurious rate. I mean, the interest rate they're going to get on this loan is somewhere between like 12 to 15% interest. So the Fed's making out on this if AIG can ever pay them back. In turn, the Treasury, that's the U.S. government, will become the majority shareholder in AIG. So between the two of them, the U.S. government and the Fed, which is a private bank, will then control AIG's business and make all the major decisions. What they're going to do then is sell the valuable assets that AIG owns, the commercial insurance portion, the plane leasing portion, et cetera, in order to pay the company's debts to their creditors, including pay the Fed back on their $85 billion loan. And, of course, all the crap, all the stuff that's worthless, will stay on the books. In other words, the U.S. government, at the end of the day, once all the assets are sold, the taxpayers will own all the junk securities. And that means, of course, even though analysts and people trying to sell the deal to the public say, oh, the U.S. government and the taxpayers could get some money back if the markets recover and these things have any value. The truth is these things are never going to really have any value. And U.S. taxpayers will be on the hook to pay the difference between how much debt AIG owes to its creditors and how much money is actually recovered once all the assets are sold. There's going to be a big gap there, and taxpayers are going to be pouring money into that hole for a while. So you might ask, why did the government get in on the deal to become the majority shareholder? The answer to that is that nobody else wanted to do it. No other bank would step in and take over AIG because, of course, nobody wants that crap on their books. And the government did it to calm the markets, essentially, by not letting AIG collapse and by ensuring that its creditors would get paid, these international banks and foreign governments and everybody who owns their debt, that was supposed to calm the markets. And then, of course, there's the bigger bailout, where the Fed and Treasury are taking a plan to Congress in order to bail out the rest of the financial industry. That includes the Treasury setting up a fund to buy back mortgage-backed securities from anybody and everybody who has this junk on their books. But most particularly, at this point, they're saying only U.S. companies, which is going to make global banking firms and foreign governments pretty ticked off, I think. But as I said, the amount of money that analysts are saying this is going to cost is about $500 billion. The truth is they don't know. They have not got a clue. And it could be much, much bigger bailout than anybody expects.
So here's why I was asking the other question earlier about the value of the loans. Wouldn't it, I mean, aside from the obvious ideology of we help the very wealthy, but not everybody else, wouldn't it solve the liquidity crisis to simply, rather than bailing out the banks, bailing out the mortgage holders?
Yeah, but
and
actually,
have them pay the banks for their actual debt so that they don't get foreclosed on their homes?
There's two ways to go about a bailout. One is to pour money in the top to save the rich guys, which is what the Bush administration's doing now. And the other is to put money in at the bottom and save the people who are losing their homes. Well, there was a one-year time frame in which the Bush administration could have and Congress could have put together a plan to do that injecting money in at the bottom to save homeowners, and that would have avoided all of this. But that time has passed. When the markets start moving, and they move very, very fast, and companies start losing the value of their stock and being unable to pay their creditors, then the only way you can bail them out really is by injecting money at the top. And because no action was done in the past year, when people kept saying, and including me, kept saying, you gotta come up with a bailout to help homeowners. Something has to be done or it's gonna get worse. Here it is. Nobody at the federal level did anything, and now it's worse.
All right. Did you want to touch on the solutions from Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain?
Do we have time?
Not a lot. We got 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll go very quickly. McCain's done multiple U-turns. I suppose you could call them flip-flops. First, he said we should have no bailouts. And then, of course, this week he said, oh, yeah, bailing out AIG is a good idea. You know, his record has been against any kind of regulation of the finance industry. But then this week he's been on the pro-regulation bandwagon. And he's not been able to address
any. In fact, he was
a
co-sponsor of that 1999 bill, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, his main advisor, Senator Phil Graham, wrote the legislation to deregulate the financial industry so that all this could come about. So, I mean, the best McCain could come up with is let's appoint a commission to study the problem, which I think points directly to the problem with him is that he doesn't understand the problem, therefore he wants a study done. Obama, on the other hand, back in March when Bear Stearns collapsed, he came up with a specific plan. He said the Fed should be able to regulate any company that borrows money from it. Boom, right there, specific plan. Regulators should set standards for how much cash on hand banks must have. There must be some kind of liquidity standard, not just capitalization standard. And that proves he understands the problem is writing risky loans and calling things assets when they're not assets and not having enough cash on hand. And then he said, third, government should create an oversight body that can identify risky types of investments before they become a systemic problem, which means he understands derivatives. And somebody who understands these things is the guy you want to go for. It doesn't necessarily mean that Obama will do a better job than McCain. He might do exactly the same thing McCain's McCain would do if McCain was in office. But it just means you're talking about somebody who knows the problem instead of being stumbling around in the dark, like the Bush administration has been.
All right. We got about 2 minutes left, Mr. Parrish, for Pakistan and Vents.
Well, let's just noting parenthetically, since we've talked about this in the past and we have several events, that the Pakistan did say this week, and not only the general, but also now the president has come out and said that if the United States puts soldiers into Pakistan again, Pakistan will have orders to shoot them. So you can expect some pilotless drones being used to kill people in Pakistan in the future.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
We're people gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting September 22nd. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for September 22nd, 1692, The New World. Someday, in hopes of putting to rest the idea that the United States was founded on religious freedom, the last 8 women hung for witchcraft in the America colonies happened. However, not only witches, but also Quakers and non-Puritan Christians were persecuted in the colonies. Also on September 22nd, 1861, in an unprovoked peacetime attack, Army soldiers massacre a band of visiting Navajo men, women, and children during a horse race at Fort Wayne, New Mexico. Mighty Christian of them. Also on September 22nd, 1862, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and the Union starts to recruit blacks to fight in the North. Robert E. Lee proposes using blacks in the Confederacy Army and emancipating them if necessary. However, another general angrily retorts, "If slaves will make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong." Duh. More First Nation Native American news in 1887, the Blackfoot Treaty. Surrendering 50,000 square miles, slightly less than the size of the state of Washington, in southwest Alberta. According to Blackfoot Chief Yellowhorn, chiefs never touched the pen and signed the treaties. The treaties were fraudulent. The chiefs were not told what was going on and did not have anyone to explain it to them. They have stolen our nationality from us. We are not Canadian nor Americans. We are Blackfoot. More governmental terrorism happens on this date in 1985, when the French finally admit planting a bomb that sunk the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior ship in New Zealand. Also on September 22nd in 2001, New York City announces a $9 million settlement for Abner Louima for the police torture that happened 4 years earlier when police beat and sodomized Abner with a plunger. This Week in Radical History for September 23rd, Victoria Woodhull would be born on this date in 1838. She was an American suffragette who helped publicize the Golden Age newspaper. As a leader of the American woman suffragette movement in the 19th century, she became a colorful and notorious symbol for women's rights, free love, and labor reform, as well as the first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872. Also for September 23, 1950, Congress overrides President Truman's veto and passes the McCarran Internal Security Act, requiring registration of members of groups the Attorney General determines to be communist fronts and establishing emergency concentration camps. Truman would call the act the greatest danger to freedom of speech, press, and assembly since the Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798. Today, KBR and Halliburton subsidiaries receive U.S. grants to build concentration camps throughout the United States, the biggest one in Alaska, where I'm sure the Palin family would volunteer to round up any commies sent their way. Two more items for September 23rd, 1983. National Kidney Foundation president decries as immoral and unethical a plan by Virginia Dr. H. Barry Jacobs to buy kidneys from poor people, among them residents of the third world nations, and sell them to wealthier people who need kidney transplants. Of course, to this day, selling of body parts to wealthier folks is standard operating procedure in a lot of third world nations.
On eBay, from Babylon back to Babylon, on eBay.
Last lastly, for September 23rd, 1997, anti-authoritarian anarcho-punk album Tub Thumper by the anarchist singing group Chumbawamba is released. Here's a little sample, a taste, a tease, if you will, a little more Chumbawamba.
A man walks into a think tank full of hooch and future sales, mixing wish lists with extension plans, read Guantanamo jail. Smell a solid beach, and a whiff of cannot fail, and a guilt trade shop with goblets, tripping cutthroat cocktails, and they drink a toast to Florida, and all its air-conditioned hum, and they damn the health of Cuba, and they damn its bona fide rum. He sucks a Kalamata olive, spits out the stone, and he mimics crushing people. Talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, delivered by hand. Nobody move, or the CEO gets it in the face with cream and dough.
See them scramble to the top, watch them fall from the race. Never trust a man.
Edison, mixing up the medicine, messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and boots and their richy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum.
Each jump in the dark, we claim as our own. We know it's a lie, we never acted alone. Each jump in the dark. Each jump in the dark.
The machine became the star. Beats to the bar. Poor Gus Dudgeon lying in his car. Down in the basement, messing with the moments. Alchemy and elements, smashing up your instrument. Old Thomas Edison, mixing up the medicine. Messing up time from Accrington to Amazon. See them all come with their wires and boots. And their richy little thumbs saying, play a funky drum. In the canteen down at Columbine, with the
bags they never found,
striking matches up at
Waco
when they
burnt it
to the ground. Without me,
Oklahoma
wasn't
possible
at all.
See my silhouette
in the Super 8
around the
grassy knoll.
Everything you know is wrong. There's a verse missing out of this song. Everything you know is wrong. Wrong, wrong. Everything you know is wrong. There's a missing out of this song. Everything you know is wrong.
This week in Radical History for September 24th, 1794, President Washington orders militia to put down Whiskey Rebellion. Farmers in the western frontier revolt when the U.S. government attempts to tax the farmers' excess grain use that they use to make whiskey. Tom the Tinker and others help organize a rebellion which mostly targeted tax collectors and their offices. The rebellion would eventually be put down by Washington himself. Also on September 24th, 1901, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman released from jail. Authorities had tried to make the case linking her to assassination of beloved President McKinley, but they would drop charges due to lack of evidence. In Wisconsin news in this date, in 1968, anti-war protesters destroyed 10,000 draft files in Milwaukee. Lastly, for September 24, 1969, Chicago 8 conspiracy trial begins, as U.S. government tries to put to trial 8 demonstrators and blame them for the massive disruption of the Democratic National Convention. At the end, the U.S. government was shown once again how much of an ass they can be. Now, after the RNC in St. Paul 2 weeks ago, a version of the Chicago 8 trials are being organized as 8 members of the RNC welcoming committee is being prosecuted on terrorism charges.
No one of us is a welcoming committee. The welcoming committee has become a target from Bob Fletcher, Ramsey County Sheriff, and from a lot of other law enforcement agents. This is an abuse of power, and when the abuse of power becomes this extreme, silence is not acceptable. When 8 people that I know and have been working with for the last year are being charged with conspiracy and acts of terrorism, silence is not acceptable. There are no terrorists on this stage. There are no terrorists in the Ramsey County Jail. There isn't one of us. There isn't 8 of us. We are all the welcoming committee, and we stand together today.
And when will they come for you? This week in Radical History for September 25th, I only have 3 items. Yep, America is founded on freedoms, like on this date in 1690 when the first newspaper was published in colonial America. It was never published again. Censorship quickly raised its ugly head as the colonists decided the paper was too offensive and ordered the publisher Benjamin Harris to cease publication. Also on September 25th, 1919, the Russian Revolution. After brutal oppression at the hands of the Bolsheviks, Cheka raids on anarchist groups, and the banning of an anarchist congress by Trotsky in June happened, underground anarchists retaliate by bombing the communist headquarters in Moscow. Underground anarchists bomb the headquarters of the Moscow Committee of the Communist Party in protest of the growing repression. 12 communists were killed and 45 others were wounded. Ain't it funny how at the same time in the United States the Palmer raids begin as governments start to seek out anarchists and jail them and or deport them? How can both communists and capitalists have the same enemy at the exact same time? Why? Because anarchist philosophy is a potent threat to authoritarian ideas, and they are quite frankly afraid of us. Lastly, on this date in 1975, Senate makes public 238 illegal FBI burglaries against dissident groups. The state crimes against the people were sponsored by what had become to be revealed as COINTELPRO, an acronym for counterintelligence programs.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and the anti-war movement. And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows. And, you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong is going to happen, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King. By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
Don't let this happen to you. That was an audio segment from the Academy Award-nominated documentary, Weather Underground. I'll check it out sometime. This week in Radical History for September 26, 1970, in England, bombs explode outside a bank in Heathrow. Just days ago, Wimbledon and Hampstead Conservative Association were hit as well. Today there are simultaneous bombs attacks in Iberia, Geneva, Frankfurt, Paris, and London airports. One of the many attacks in England and France during this year, many attributed by the media to the anarchist Angry Brigade. Living up to the press release motto, Better Living Through Chemistry, in 1973, radioactive tritium discovered in drinking water near Rock Flats Dow Chemical Nuclear Power Plant in Colorado. Also on September 26, 1985, Senator Jesse Helms adds an amendment to an appropriations bill forbidding the use of any funds for the benefit of any cult organization or other group that has the purpose or that has any interest in the promoting of Satanism or witchcraft. It is adopted without debate, showing once again how America is all about religious tolerance. So mote it be. But we are not the only country with religious intolerance, like in 2002 in Burma, when 14 are sentenced to death for trying to overthrow the government by the use of magic. Lastly, on a state in 1997, Mexico, Zapatista rebels found an autonomous community in southern Chiapas that still operates to this day. This week in radical history, for September 28, 1893, Emma Goldman goes on trial in New York City, sent back to the tombs until the 18th of October, the day sent for sentence, with the judge given a new rent-free home for a year in Blackwater Island Penitentiary. Her crime, given a speech. Also on September 28, 1901, in the Philippines, guerrillas ambush U.S. troops, killing 48 U.S. soldiers. General Jack Smith orders his troops to kill everyone on the island. Following his butchery, Hell-Roaring Jake was promoted to Brigadier General and put in charge of the Samar campaign to pacify our little brown brothers. In Samar, Smith earned fame with his orders to kill everyone over the age of 10 and make the island in a howling wilderness. In May of 1902, Smith was court-martialed and was forced retired with no other punishment. The travesty of our involvement in the Philippines, when we had designs to turn it into our westernmost state, and many of these turn-of-the-century atrocities go largely forgotten in this country's history. Also on September 28, 1917, 166 Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union activists, indicted for interfering with the war effort, you know, the war to end all wars, the first move on an illegal but successful U.S. government campaign to cripple the radical union movement. A year later in Canada, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union, is outlawed. Also on the state in 1919, a mob forms outside Omaha, Nebraska courthouse. The courthouse set afire and Mayor Ed P. Smith is hung. They seize William Brown, a black man, accused of raping a white woman. He was tossed in jail, though he is crippled. The mob gets him, hangs him, shoots him, and then drags his body through the town. After committing these acts of murder, the mob goes on a rampage throughout downtown Omaha, breaking windows and stealing goods from storefronts. Troops are finally called in on the 30th to put an end to the chaos. It is considered one of the most notorious lynchings in U.S. history, involving tens of thousands of good Christian people. Two more items for September 28, 1973. ITT headquarters in New York is bombed by the Weather Underground in response to U.S.-backed coup in Chile. Lastly, in 1990, President Reagan says, quote, "We have never interfered with the internal government of any country," unquote. This guy was not only elected president, America loves to regale his fairy tales. Yeah, we've never interfered with the internal affairs of any country. Never. Never happened. Pay no attention to the man.
Pay no attention to the man. Pay no attention to the man. Pay no attention to the man. Pay no attention to the man. Pay no attention to
the man. When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends, and some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper. There were three of us this morning. I'm the only one this evening, but I must go on. The frontiers are my prison.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. And more radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more info. A reminder of what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
J'ai repris mon âme. J'ai changé 100 fois de nom. J'ai perdu femme et enfant.
j'ai tant d'amis. J'ai la France entière. Un vieil homme dans un grenier, pour la nuit nous a cachés, les Allemands l'ont pris. Il est mort sans surprise.
Graves, the wind is blowing, freedom soon will come. Then we'll come from the shadow.
Sleep now, it'll hurt less in the morning.